In the summer of 2011, I began working at a church that many people I knew called a blasphemous place. It was the Presbyterian Church USA. And I guess my local Lutheran pastor, who's also a very close family friend, was so concerned that I was working for this church that he needed to address the issue between glasses of wine at my family's Christmas Eve gathering. And so he sat next to me at the table, and he began asking me a litany of questions about the Presbyterian Church USA's various theologies. And at the end of our conversation, he looked me in the eye, and he said, "Michael, just promise me one thing. You won't let those people convince you women can be pastors." And I stood up, I smiled, I nodded, and I beelined to the closest bottle of wine. And when it comes to women's roles in the church and in the family, there are two prevailing thought patterns which govern American churches, and those definitions are on the last page here of the bulletin. The first, this traditional viewpoint, is complementarianism. An evangelical scholar, Wayne Grudem, defines complementarianism as a belief that men and women are equal in value and dignity, but men and women have different roles in marriage as part of the created order. So complementarians believe that men are the head of the family and that women should submit to their husband's authority. Complementarians also believe that God exclusively calls men to exercise spiritual authority. So in these churches, this is kind of how it works. Women can teach children or youth Sunday school. Women could teach a woman's Bible study. But women cannot serve as an ordained minister. And they cannot teach a Bible study where there's at least one adult male present. The other thought pattern is egalitarianism. And as the term is used in the church, egalitarianism is this belief that all believers, regardless of gender, ethnicity, or class, must exercise their God-given gifts with equal authority and equal responsibility in the church, the home, and the world. So in this structure, women can serve in all capacities, right? Serve in every position in the church, and women also take on a shared leadership in the family structure. So, complementarian critics will argue that egalitarian churches or denominations like ours, that we don't take the Bible seriously. And so today I want to demonstrate how one can both revere the Bible, find it to be authoritative in their lives, and believe that women should be ordained. So to start this conversation, we're going to start at the beginning, in Genesis. And in Genesis 2:23, the woman is created. And in that verse, there becomes a clear distinction between male and female. The Hebrew word to describe Adam is different before and after Eve is created, right? Before Eve, the Hebrew word ha-adam refers to Adam. And this term means the earthling. Adam is the earthling. It has no connotation for gender. Instead, at the beginning, Adam, as the earthling, encapsulates all of humanity because he's the only human that exists. Yet God declares that it's not good for this earthling to be alone. So God creates a helper, Eve. Complementarians use this story to say that, well, Adam was created first, and because Adam was created first, and Adam has authority over Eve, men have authority over women. They also say that the word helper references a power dynamic where the husband has absolute authority and the wife submits to it. However, Adam, and being created first, is not yet a man. Adam is an earthling who is male and female and everything in between. He's all of humanity. Also, when God declares it's not good for this earthling to be alone, this Hebrew word for helper is not like the Hebrew word in English. It doesn't have a power dynamic to it. The Hebrew word refers to anyone who provides assistance or aid. So the Hebrew word for helper implies mutuality, not submission. But as we continue reading in Genesis, complementarians claim that God establishes God's intentions more or clearer when he curses Eve and tells her, "Your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you." And I just find it hard to believe that this curse, after Adam and Eve have eaten the fruit, I find it hard to believe this curse describes God's intentions for how we should live. Right? Instead, it appears that this curse describes sinful relations between men and women that result from the fall. After the fall, we are cursed to desire, and we are cursed to try to rule over each other. Because you see, Genesis 1 to 3, before this fall, paints a perfect picture of equality and harmony. And it's not until sin enters into the world that the harmony is broken. And as such, when I read Genesis, I believe that Christians should try to imitate this original harmony and equality of the garden instead of clinging to subjugation and subordination. Another verse or another book of the Bible, which complementarians often use to say that women can't serve in ordained ministry, is 1 Corinthians. And as we look at several of these passages here, I just want us to keep in mind that in 1 Corinthians, Paul is writing to a church, a specific one, and Paul and the people reading this letter have knowledge about the context that we don't have because we weren't there. And so there's a lot of ambiguity in this letter, and it's hard to discern what that means for the church today. So the first passage at issue in 1 Corinthians 11 is this chapter which concerns whether men and women should wear head coverings in church. You know, I see a lot of us forgot our hats today. And in the midst of this discussion, one of the verses says, "Christ is the head of every man, and the husband is the head of his wife, and God is the head of Christ." And complementarians read this verse and say, "Women, you got to submit to your husband's authority, your husband's headship." However, it's really unlikely that the Greek word in the original New Testament concerns authority. It'd be better translated as source. And it makes a lot of sense because in this verse, Paul's referring to that Genesis story. Right? Paul is noting that all of creation comes from Christ, that Christ was present in the garden. And so it goes like this. All of creation comes from Christ. The woman comes from the man's rib, and Christ comes from God. The verse would then read, Christ is the source of every man. The husband is the source of every wife, because again, Adam's rib was given to Eve. And that God is the source of Christ. God sent Christ into the world. And so this doesn't connotate an authority structure. It's just describing how creation operated. If we also look at 1 Corinthians 11, we look at Paul's conclusion, like what's his main point at the end of these verses, we see a very liberatory reading for people of all genders. Paul writes, "Nevertheless, in the Lord, woman is not independent of man, or man independent of woman." Right? There's interdependence communicated here. There's a mutuality communicated here. Because our intimate relationships with each other, they're essential for us. We need mutual partnership to love and be loved. And then verse 12 says that, "For just as a woman came from man," Eve from Adam, "so man comes from woman, but all things come from God." Right? Men today come from women. And all things come from God. And we remember in Genesis 1 that God creates all people in God's image. And so as equal image bearers, it would appear that we are free to participate in the glory of God. Each as equal image bearers, free to participate in all capacities in the church. Now, the second and most controversial Corinthians verse comes from 1 Corinthians 14, and that states pretty plainly, women should be silent in the churches. Just before getting to an explanation, I think it's important to say that many scholars believe that these verses were added by editors later into the ancient text to try to limit women's role in the church, because these verses disrupt the flow of Paul, and they also contradict 1 Corinthians 11, which says that women should pray and prophesy in church, which is kind of hard to do silently. And so, but regardless of whether or not these verses are original to Paul or not, I don't think these verses suggest that Paul is saying women must be silent in all churches for all time. Right? He's addressing women who cause disorder during worship. In the same chapter, Paul also asks people who speak in tongues to be silent when no interpreter is present. He also asks people who prophesy to be silent during parts of the service. And the chapter concludes with this: "My friends, be eager to prophesy. Do not forbid speaking in tongues, but all things should be done decently and in order." So it appears that this 1 Corinthians 14 is not some universal declaration, but it's an exhortation concerning order and silence during particular parts of worship. It's just like saying, hey, please don't talk during the sermon. It's not a universal, enduring will of God. However, like for Corinthians, we're going to look at one final verse here. In 1 Timothy 2, it asks women to submit to the teaching authority of men. So a lot of people will say, well, 1 Corinthians says women should be silent. 1 Timothy 2 says they submit to the teaching authority of men. We see it in two places. It must be for all time. But I think when we consider this verse, we have to remember that when the Bible is written, right, when the New Testament is being written, 90% of the population was illiterate. And formal schooling was reserved only for upper-class men. So if we consider this context, I think Paul's prohibition makes sense. Paul is asking women who have likely not received much education in this formal education system to submit to male teachers until they learn. And then when they have learned enough, they can teach on their own. Right? The concern in these verses is right doctrine. Paul does not want people to be in churches learning from uneducated people. He wants people to learn first, and once they have learned, then they can teach. Now, these are several of the verses which complementarians use to claim that women cannot hold pastoral authority. But I think more importantly for us, there are a litany of verses which have a proactive argument, a formative argument, which suggests that women played a substantial role in leading the early church. So in the book of Acts, we have this couple, Priscilla and Aquila. And they're married, and they accompany Paul on his trip to the church at Ephesus. And when Paul leaves, he asks this couple to remain. And the couple attends worship at a synagogue where a man named Apollos preaches about Jesus. And after they hear Apollos' sermon at the synagogue, Priscilla and Aquila, the Bible says, quote, takes Apollos aside and explain the way of God to him more accurately. And these verses do not indicate that Priscilla, the wife, kept silent while her husband taught Apollos the way of God. And in fact, what's even more curious is that in every reference to this couple, Priscilla, the wife, is referenced first. And it suggests that Priscilla, a woman, could indeed teach and exercise spiritual authority over a man, could teach Apollos the way of God more accurately. And this argument strengthened because Priscilla's not alone. In Romans 16, a woman named Phoebe is called a deacon of the church. And the same word used to describe Phoebe describes male deacons in other places in the New Testament. It also appears that Phoebe was the person who had the honor to carry Paul's letter to the church at Rome. meaning that Phoebe was also the one who read the letter aloud to the entire congregation, who had that authority to communicate Paul's words to the congregation. And there's also someone else in Romans. Romans also references a woman named Junia. Romans calls her an apostle, and she is commended in a verse alongside a male apostle in the early church. And I think this is interesting. Christianity's sort of patriarchy is so strong that when early translators saw Junia's name, they said, that can't possibly be a woman. So they changed the name to a man. And for years, the man's name was in the Bible until later they finally said, they re-looked at the Greek and said, no, that's not a man's name. That's a woman's name. So literally, they changed the name of a woman in the Bible who it suggested was a leader in the church to try to ensure that women could not lead. And if we take these together, these references indicate that women had the opportunity to teach and preach and lead in the early church. But my favorite argument for women's leadership in the church appears in all four Gospels. After Jesus' death, the women of the Jesus movement go to the tomb to anoint him. Right in our scripture reading today in Matthew, an angel appears to Mary Magdalene and the other Mary and says, Jesus is not here. Go quickly and tell his disciples he has been raised from the dead. And as Mary and Mary rush to inform the disciples, Jesus appears to them and says to them, do not be afraid. Go tell my brothers in Galilee. They will see me there. And so if we compare the men and women in this story, while Peter is denying Jesus three times before the cock crows, while Judas is deciding to take his own life in shame, and while the rest of the disciples are hiding out from the Roman government, it's the women who are bold enough to approach the tomb to discover the risen Christ. It's the women whom Christ first appears to. It's the women who become the first teachers of the gospel. It's the women who Jesus calls to spread the good news, to go and tell the disciples that Christ cannot be contained by death, that Christ is risen, and that hope abounds. Now, as a man, I can't really fully articulate what it means to be part of a church which welcomes women into all roles of leadership. And so I asked several women in our church to share what it means to them. And we'll post all of the responses in a blog post on our website and on social media. But here are a few of the responses from members of our congregation. One member said that as a 12-year-old girl, she witnessed her congregation elect its first female ruling elder. She says this experience proved that she could, quote, be anything she wanted to be. And that seeing this woman ordained as a ruling elder caused her to believe in herself and believe in the church. Another member commented that she grew up in a church where women were only allowed to cook the potlucks and teach small children. And when she visited First Presbyterian Lebanon, she realized that the only constraint keeping her from serving God as an elder was made by man and not from God. And so this realization liberated her and allowed her to use her gifts by serving as a member of our session several times. And she was so excited that she could, quote, finally able to serve God in any and every way possible. And here's one last story. One member of our church said this, I grew up in a church where I watched women do meaningful work to sustain the congregation and its day-to-day operations with little credit and no ability to serve in official leadership capacities. And the older I got, the more I realized I was not cut out to fall in step with those patterns of patriarchal leadership. Amid so much unrecognized matriarchal leadership happening right in front of me. And the inability to reconcile this contradiction, she said it distanced her from any church for more than a decade. And she said she will always be grateful for the inclusive leadership and open doors and open arms that she found here at First Presbyterian Lebanon that helped her back to a more regular and intentional practice and observance of her faith. Friends, our theologies have consequences. Or when we limit people's calling to serve God, it hurts. It causes pain and distress. It causes people to lose their faith and to seek answers elsewhere. So I'll end today with this. If you're someone who grew up in churches which refused to recognize your gifts as a teacher and a leader, if you're someone who grew up in churches which placed all of your value on childbearing, if you're someone who grew up in churches who claimed that to belong to them required submission, I just want you to know, and I want everyone to know, that Christ came into the world to eliminate every artificial, man-made barrier which keeps us from living into our God-ordained callings. I want you to know that for everyone, regardless of your gender, that Christ sees you as worthy and beloved. That Christ sees you and Christ says, in the church of Jesus Christ, no matter who you are, you belong. And you are called to serve in whatever capacity in which you desire. You belong.